Okay. One moment. My wife has signaled that she is cold. Here you go, babe. I have a question for everybody before we start. We are actually, as of now, we're in lesson 22 out of 26. So we're getting to the end. What's that? No? Okay, yeah, that's what we're going to talk about, right? Don't worry. Yeah, I know. I know that's my mother. I've lived with her for a long time. I know very well that's my mother. So I have a question for the class, and I'm ready to go either way, right? So my question for the class is, for the rest of our New Testament study, right, we have two options, right? I would like to take things in a chronological order, if that's okay, because that's sort of what we've been doing so far, for the most part anyway. Things are going to, for the most part, be in a chronological order. So after we look at the synoptics, right, and I've spoken with the elders about this sort of off and on, and I think it was okay. Next is the book of Acts, right? And so the question I have for the class, and I asked the elders about this, and they said ask the class. So I'm following the directive of the elders at this point. Would you guys like to study Acts as a whole and then look at the epistles? Or would you like to study Acts and the epistles together in chronological order? What I mean by that is, for example, the way we would do that, if we're taking Acts and the epistles together in chronological order, we would look at Acts chapters 1 through 14, and then we would look at Galatians, then we would look at Acts chapter 15, and we'd look at James, right? And then we continue on, and then we look at Paul's first journey, and then we look at the letters that he wrote on that event, and then we look at Paul's second journey, and then we take a look at like Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians that he writes on his second journey. Then we take a look at his third journey and look at the things that he writes then, and then we look at 1st Timothy and the other books that he writes in between his third journey and his fourth, we take a look at the prison epistles, then 1st Timothy and the things that he writes in between, and then we take a look at 2nd Timothy at the end. So what we would be doing is we'd be breaking the book of Acts up into sections, right? And we'd be inserting the various epistles in their actual historical context within the book of Acts, right? So those are basically our two options for how to approach a study of the New Testament. By the way, I'm saving John's writings for the end, right? I'm dealing with those entirely separately. So I know we're in the Synoptic Gospels right now, and I'm going straight to Acts, and I'm not doing John. That's on purpose. Because I want to take John's writings all in a singular piece, right? So that's why they're all at the end of the study. Plus, they're probably the last things that are written anyway. So they fit there anyway. What do you guys think as a class? You like breaking it up? That sounds like a good idea to you guys? Okay, all right. There we go. Right, we're gonna show all the books that are written in their chronological order in which they're written, right? And so once we finish the book of Acts, that's when we'll be taking a look at like 1st and 2nd Peter and Jude, right? Actually, those are probably the last things we're gonna look at before we look at John's writings. Okay, all right, cool. Now I have a direction. Seems like that's the general consensus of people who have bothered to speak up. So if you disagree, do it now, or else that's the way it's gonna go. Okay, that's the way it's going to go. Time's up. All right, so, okay, I wanted to pull the class on that real quick, because I'm essentially ready to start getting the ball rolling either way. That's okay. back into class, back into the Synoptic Gospels. So, where did we leave off last week? Anybody remember? We're in Matthew 23, right? So, we're in Matthew chapter 23. We're in about verse 13 or so, or no, 16, right? Because the last thing we talked about was the habit of Pharisees of making proselytes, which, number one, was never demanded under the law to begin with. people had to insist on it, right? And number two, their entire mental perspective on it was flawed to begin with, because the things that they were teaching these people were also flawed, right? So, the next thing, and remember, this is Jesus' last public discourse, and it's angry. This is the last thing that he has to say in public, right? He has things to say after this, but they're directed toward either the 12 or to his disciples, right? This is the last that's given to the public, to the crowds, and it's angry, right? It sounds like Jeremiah. And he's giving it, and he's directing it toward the religious leadership of his day, namely the Pharisees and the scribes, right? These people are the targets. And we've talked about this before. Why is his last, you know, why in the world would his last public discourse be directed toward these individuals? And it all boils down to the fact that these are the men who should be the leaders, right? They're the men who should be the first to join his cause. But they're not. And he holds them accountable for that. And he holds them accountable for not only not being amongst the first of his disciples, but for being amongst the most ardent of his opponents. And this is a very, this is, there's a lot of anger behind this. And because in their wrong-headed efforts to preserve what they think is important, they're actually working against God, right? And that's where the anger is coming from. So, we've gone through the initial criticisms of the scribes and the Pharisees. So, we have the first one there. Their hypocrisy regarding the execution of the law, right? They know what it says, but they won't do it. And in addition to the things that they won't do, they also tell people to do things that aren't even in the law to begin with. And they themselves are not willing to bear the burdens that they're binding on other people. And then he talks about their love of preeminence, their love of glory in the eyes of men. Then he deals with their the problems regarding their making of proselytes and their the fact that they say, no, you can't be part of God's people, right? And all the practices there. And so when it comes to verse 16, he's continuing this harangue against them. And what does the word woe mean? Sorrow, right? But not just sorrow, right? There's a little bit more than that. Sorrow, pain, anguish, right? You will be sorry for what you've done. Woe to you, scribes. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. You hypocrites. You have no idea of the position that you've put yourselves in because of this, right? You, anguish and pain and sorrow are in store for you and you don't even realize it. So let me tell you why. And then he says, woe to you, scribes. Woe to you, blind guides who say, what are they saying? What's the problem? Nobody read, huh? Okay, we read. All right, so why aren't we answering? Okay. Phyllis? Okay, if anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing. What in the world are they talking about? What are they talking about? Okay, but what practice are they referring to? What's going on here? Okay, but what are we actually talking about? I mean, the swearing by the temple, what's going on there? Okay, well, the practice they're engaging in, let's liken it to something that we engage in today. Idolatry. Okay. But what are they actually, I'm not talking about what are they doing that are wrong, what's the thing that they're actually doing? Swearing by the temple or swearing by the gold in the temple. Like, what's the equivalent of that today? I swear to God. Right? Thank you, Judy. That's what I'm getting at. That's what we're talking about. I swear to God. Right? Or when you take an oath before you're sworn in as a witness in court or you give a deposition, right? Very often, what do you put your hand on? A Bible, right? What's the oath? I solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. so help me God. Right? That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Right? And so, the insanity that they engage in is that if you swear by the temple, that doesn't mean anything. You don't have to keep your oath. But if you swear by the gold in the temple, then you have to keep your oath. What in the, what, why are they making this distinction? Why do they think like one is okay but the other's not? Like it's okay to break your vow if you just swear by the temple itself. By the way, does God tell the Israelites to swear by anything in the Old Testament? Incorrect. Take another stab at it. Does God tell the Israelites to swear by anything in the Old Testament? Someone said, no, I said that was incorrect. So what's the other answer? Yes, absolutely he does. He does. There's nothing greater than him, right? But he tells them to swear by his name. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 10, by the way. And yeah, let's just so you guys know I'm not making this up. Everybody turn to Deuteronomy 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10. Right. This whole bit starts in verse 12. It's the bit that finds the meat of the discussion in verse 16 where he says, circumcise therefore the foreskin of your hearts and be no longer stubborn. Verse 17, he says, for the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and he loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. So love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God. You shall serve him and hold fast to him, and by his name you shall swear. He is your praise. He is your God who has done for you these great and terrifying things that your eyes have seen. That's Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 20. That's verse 20. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 20. So, yeah, right at the end of the verse. The last words in the verse. Do you see it now? It's there. Do you see it, Alexia? Okay. But it's there in verse 20. So when David says, as Yahweh lives, right? As the Lord lives, is how it's written in English translations. Is he following the law? Is he? Yeah, he actually is, right? But the thing about this is, and this relates to the third commandment, right? You shall not take the name, you shall not use the name of Yahweh your God. Did you see it? Yeah. So, like the third commandment, you shall not use the name of Yahweh your God lightly, right? Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That doesn't mean don't use the name, okay? And that doesn't mean don't swear by the name, because Deuteronomy 10:20 says swear by the name, right? So, the commandment can't mean don't do that. The commandment is, when you do it, you better keep that vow. Right? Right. And Jesus says it, you know, simply it says we shouldn't even have to make the oath in the first place, but if you do, you better keep it. Right? So it's not wrong to make the oath or to use the name of God when swearing an oath. It's not wrong at all. As a matter of fact, it's consistent with Deuteronomy. It's perfectly okay. But the thing is, you better make sure you keep that vow. Right? And, you know, Jesus speaks of being in people of integrity apart from making vows, right? But that doesn't mean that the practice of making vows is somehow wrong or somehow not an okay thing to do. But what he's getting at here is the Pharisees are engaging in typical rabbinical Judaism practice where, you know, they're nitpicking about certain things, right? And so they're saying, oh, the temple is just a building, but the things, the gold in the temple... By the way, what is the gold in the temple? What are they talking about when they say the gold in the temple? the ark, the table of the bread of the presence, the menorah, the lamp, the lampstand, right? Right? They're talking about the instruments that were used in worship, right? So if you swear by the gold that's in the temple, well, you got to keep that. Well, why? Because that's used in the worship of God. Well, dude, so is the building. But this goes down to a typical Pharisaic problem. Is, again, what's the big problem of the Pharisees? Hypocrisy, right? But what manifestation does that hypocrisy take very often? Do they think that they're God's people? Do they think that they're worshiping God? What are they really worshiping? I mean, what's their relationship with the law like? This goes to the heart of what's wrong with them. That's a symptom of the problem, right? That's one way the problem manifests itself. Right. What they do. Right. So the problem, the root problem with the Pharisees, at its most basic, right, at its most foundational issue, is this. The Pharisees worship the law instead of the God who wrote it. Right. And that's their problem. They worship the law instead of the God who wrote it. And that's what leads to all their other problems. Right, they're idolizing the law itself, and so they're not taking God's character into account, and so you have the problems with the Sabbath that they have. They forgot why God gave the Sabbath, and they forgot what the Sabbath is for, and they forgot that the Sabbath isn't just the day, it's the year, and it's the year of Jubilee, right? And so it's the perfect time for healing, right? It's the perfect day for Jesus to be healing people, right? But that's escaping their brain because they're not thinking about that. Right? So they worship the law instead of the God who wrote it. And that leads to all their other problems. Yeah.
I just have a question while we're on that.
Sure.
I can only remember two couple passages before that, and I'm just wondering about, I don't even know if I ever even studied in Greek if what maybe the word was, but Jesus talks about when he's in the Sermon on the Mount.
Right. Right.
And James talks about it, about the, just let your yes be yes and your no be no.
Right.
Not to swear.
Right. So in, so what Jesus is doing, in Matthew chapter 5 verses 33 to 37, that's the section of the Sermon on the Mount where he deals with this. One of the things to remember, right, is, first of all, when James does it, James is quoting the Sermon on the Mount, right? So any discussion about James can actually be covered in a discussion on the Sermon on the Mount, right? Because when James quotes Jesus, right, his brother, this is what he's doing. This is bringing all this stuff to mind, right? So the Sermon on the Mount is about correction, right? And sort of bottom line, there's two passages that, there's two things that Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, that guide how we look at what he says. Number one, right, is unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you can by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Right? So, number two, right, is the last verse in chapter 5. You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Right? So that guides how we understand the Sermon on the Mount. Right? So what Jesus is presenting on the Sermon on the Mount is the perfect ideal. That's what he's talking about. This is the standard to which we hold ourselves. This is what we strive for, right? This is what we want to be. And so, in a perfect world, a perfect Christian would never need to give a vow. Because everyone would know automatically that if he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. Or that if he says something, it's true, it's absolutely true, because he would never lie, right? And this is the perfect world scenario. And that's what Jesus is presenting in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have to strive for this. As a matter of fact, the whole point is we have to strive for it, right? But sometimes what happens is people don't always know this about us, or people don't always trust this about us. And sometimes we ourselves are the problem, and we ourselves are the ones who are flawed. And that's the way life works. That's the unfortunate, unpleasant, gritty, and unsatisfactory reality. But that's the way it is, right? We're not perfect. Romans 3:23, right? Do not be deceived, right? All have fallen short of the glory of God. So Jesus is presenting the perfect ideal, right? Now, we strive to live up to that. But there's also sometimes in which society requires us to make a vow, to make an oath, right? That's essentially what we do every time we sign a contract, isn't it? Or every time you click accept on an end-user license agreement, for those of us who live in the digital age, right? How many of us ever actually read the EULA? Yeah. Not me. I saw an article, as a matter of fact, by a website that is... it's religiously oriented satire, right? So it's for done for comedic purposes that, you know, and the headline was, you know, God sends fire to consume man who clicked accept without reading the EULA, right? Because he bore false witness. but, you know, that's essentially what we're doing. We're making a vow, right? And we sign a contract, we're making a promise, right? We're making a vow. You know, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, don't even bother. But, you know, sometimes we have to anyway, right? Because that's the scenario. And that's the way the world works, right? And that's the way societies work. Sometimes societies need an extra promise. And it's okay when that happens. But when that happens, you better make sure you keep it. Especially if you do it in the name of God. And if you do, it's okay. See Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 20. Right? Elmore? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, marriage is a great example, right? You know, we make a vow. You know, if we're God's people, should we need to make that special, extra special vow? No, because if I say it, it should be true, right? But we do it because that's what society expects of us, and that's a thing that we've got. And, you know, it's okay, right? Yeah, Alexia had her hand up, and then back to Elmore. Alexia. Yeah.
But what I see is they don't worship the law. I think for me, they pick and choose the law that they want to do.
A better way to say it, Alexia's right, a better way to say it might be that they worship their perception of the law.
Exactly. So they only do the law that will give them whatever it is they want to have. But the law is the other law that they don't want to do because it affects them, affecting them, not giving them any benefit. They don't do it.
Right. They worship their perception of the law, right? Which plays actually helps if we rephrase it that way. Thank you for that, by the way, clarification. If we rephrase it that way, that also helps us understand their idolization of their national identity too, right? So Elmore, follow up. Making a covenant, right? Well, first of all, let's use baptism as an example, okay? Right? Because first of all, Peter actually says in Greek, right, in 1 Peter 3:21, that baptism is making a vow. He says it flat out. So if it's not okay to make a vow, you can never get baptized. I mean, you see the problems with that, right? Right? So it's not what Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount, and this also covers James, because James is again quoting the Sermon on the Mount. So any discussion in James can be covered by looking at the Sermon on the Mount. So what Jesus is actually saying is not, don't, first of all, understand, Jesus also engaged in hyperbole. He would exaggerate to make a point, right? And that's kind of what he's doing in the Sermon on the Mount a lot, right? So he says, don't even think about making a vow, right? Then he's trying to impress upon his audience the importance of integrity and honesty in speech and that the comparison between your speech and your actions, right? That they need to be consistent. They need to match up, right? What you say should be what you do, right? There should be a consistency between that. And he doesn't literally mean never make a vow. Because if he meant that, then he couldn't say, go baptize people, right? Because Peter says that's a vow, right? The word appeal that's in, I think, is the New American Standard, the ESV, all translated as appeal. And I've said before, as much as I love to bag on the NIV, right, they actually get this one right. They say it's the pledge to God of a good conscience. It's the vow, it's the oath of a God to the oath to God of a good conscience. And that's actually the word that Peter uses in Greek. That's straight up what it means. And you can't really get around that. And so the whole concept of a vow, let's use baptism. You're making a vow to God when you do that. Which is why Paul says in Romans 11, was it 29, 30? In that framework, he says the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. You've made a promise to God. You've made a vow to God. And it's solemn and it's holy and it binds you, and you better keep it for the rest of your life. So that's why you give yourself as a living sacrifice. But, you know, like I said before, there's a whole lot of people who all they want to do is just crawl down off the altar whenever it's convenient. Like the Pharisees, right? Whenever it's convenient, they set aside the law. And this whole issue of making promises by, or making a vow by the temple or the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath. He says, you blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? You know, first of all, you know, when the instruments of worship were first constructed, way back in Exodus, right? Do you guys remember the first thing that had to be done to them? You guys remember? This is actually kind of an important thing. Okay, so the first thing that had to be done with them is Moses had to offer a sacrifice and sprinkle the instruments of worship with blood, because they had to be purified from the sinful hands of the men who made them. Think about that for a minute. You know why Uzzah was struck dead? What was Uzzah's big mistake? I mean, no, he reached out to touch the ark when it was, when he went over a rut, right? But that wasn't his biggest mistake. That wasn't. He's afraid the ark's going to get dirty from the ground, right? And his biggest mistake is related to that. Right. Yeah, right. Alexia's right. Uzzah's biggest mistake was thinking that his sinful hand was cleaner than the dirt on the ground. That was Uzzah's biggest mistake. And that's the presumption that God killed him for, was thinking that his sinful, defiled hand was somehow cleaner than just dirt on the ground that God himself had made. Dirt wouldn't defile the ark, but his hand certainly would. That was his greatest mistake. Right? And so, and what Jesus is pointing out, you know, which is more holy? Right? The fact that they're used in God's worship, that's what makes it holy. So the building's actually better than the stuff that's in it, because, you know, look at the purpose that it exists for, right? But if you're going to make an oath at all, swear by God and then keep it. But better yet, I mean, if you're going to engage in this nonsense, right? He says, you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, then he is bound to his oath. It's like, oh my goodness, seriously? That thing's just an animal's carcass, all right? It's just a dead, burning, and rotting animal carcass. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift on the altar, or the gift, or the altar that makes a gift sacred? Because without the altar, that thing is just cooking food. It's food that's cooking. It's just barbecue. It's the altar that turns that barbecue into a sacrifice. Because without the altar, it's just barbecue. That's all it is. So, whoever swears by the altar swears by it and everything on it. Whoever swears by the temple swears by it and him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. And here, he's actually referencing his own comments that Mom made reference to back in Matthew chapter 5, verses 33 to 37. Because there, he talks about people swearing by heaven or by the throne of God in heaven. Right? So he's actually calling back to... Here we have a built-in reference back to what Mom was talking about in the Sermon on the Mount. So, by the way, this whole discussion about vows and oaths and swearing by certain things gives us an example to deal with what Alexia was talking about, the Pharisees' own perception of the law and which bits of the law were important. So let's like, this is sort of one of the great Pharisees' greatest problem manifests itself in a lot of different ways that Jesus is going to get into here in Matthew 23. So let's go ahead and deal with this. The Pharisees are the beginning of what we would call rabbinical Judaism, right? They were the first rabbis, right? In the very system of rabbis that Jews have today. And rabbinical Judaism is basically, rabbinical Judaism traditions are basically one long 2,000-year-old exercise in which laws do we like and which laws do we not like, and how can we use the laws that we like to ignore the laws that we don't like. That's basically what rabbinical Judaism is built around. And I'll give you guys an example. During the Feast of Tents, what is Israel supposed to do? Go outside and make a tent, right? And what do you do at the tent? What do you do during the festival? You live in it for how long? For 1 week, for 7 days, right? For 7 days, you live in a tent, right? You go outside of your house, and you build a temporary shelter, and you live in your temporary shelter for a week. Why? To remember the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, right? And what was every adult male in Israel supposed to do? What's that? Well, every male was supposed to be circumcised, but during the Feast of Tents, what was every adult male in Israel supposed to do? Where were they supposed to celebrate the Feast of Tents? Where were they supposed to build their tents? What about the adult males in Israel? Where were they supposed to build their tents? They were supposed to camp around the Ark of the Covenant. Whether it was in the tabernacle in Shiloh or after it had been moved into Jerusalem, they're supposed to camp outside the city of Jerusalem. Right? It was one of the three pilgrimage festivals in Israel. You get the Feast of Tents, you get the Feast of Weeks, and you got Passover. Those are the three pilgrimage festivals. Every adult male was supposed to converge on wherever the Ark of the Covenant was, and they were supposed to encamp around the Ark of the Covenant for the duration of the festival. Back to Leviticus and Deuteronomy, right? The women and children can stay at home, but the men have to be at the ark. That was the law, right? So, modern Judaism, right? I've shared this story before, but I'm going to share it again because it comes up, right? So the rule is, first of all, you're supposed to go where the ark is, right? So where's the ark today? It's in a warehouse with top men, right? I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that reference. But we don't know, right? It's lost. It's lost. It's the way it is. So can you even celebrate the Feast of Tents properly these days? Nope. Nope. Can't, right? But if you were going to, how should you do it? Pilgrimage to Jerusalem, right? Every adult male Jew needs to get on a plane and fly their keister to Jerusalem. Make a camp outside the city, have a temporary shelter, and live in that for a week. You know, you want to know how they celebrate the Feast of Tents in the Jews who live in Gaza or West Bank? How they do it? This is an exercise in getting around the law. This is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about, right? So what they do is they build their houses. But when they build their houses in a square pattern, right? But the middle of the square is actually empty. There's no roof over it, right? It's an open-air courtyard, right? So the house is actually the perimeter of a square that's building, right? But the inside of the square is a smaller square that has no roof, right? It's open to the air. So what they do is during the Feast of Tents, they take bamboo slats and they roll them over that square that's in the middle, this open-air courtyard, and that's their temporary shelter. You think Moses would say that passes muster? but it's leafy plants like the law says to use, right? And it is temporary because we're just going to roll them back when the festival is over and we're technically outside. No, actually, you're not. You're still in your house. You've got walls around you, okay? This is exactly what we're talking about, right? They're getting around the law. First of all, to a Jew, to be proper before God, he would have to acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah, but that's beside the point. And that would mean they didn't need to do all this stuff anymore, but that's also beside the point. But this is the kind of thing the Pharisees would engage in. The Jews today who do that, they learned from the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the ones who started all this, right? They're the experts at it, right? And so in Luke, Jesus brings up another example. We're going to get to verse 23 in a second, right? That's sort of another manifestation of this, right? But in Luke, Jesus talks about how the Pharisees would sit and the scribes were there and they would tell people that, you know, you don't really have to take care of your parents in their old age, and here's how you can get around that. Because whenever your mom and dad come asking you if they can live with you or if they can get money or whatever they want, all you've got to do is tell them, whatever I would have given you, I've already pre-dedicated to God. Korban, it's under the ban, right? Whatever I would have had for you, I've already sort of ahead of time decided to give that to God, so I got nothing left for you, mom and dad, sorry. You think Moses would say that passes muster? No, right? But this is it, right? This is using the law to get around the law. And this is what the Pharisees were experts at, right? They would pick and choose portions of the law that they liked and use the portions of the law that they liked to negate the portions of the law that they didn't like. And that's how that was their standard order of business, right? That's how they operated. So, in Matthew 23, right? He gets at something else, right? He says, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you tithe. What do they tithe? Mint, dill, and cumin, right? Are those expensive spices? Back in those days, absolutely. You tithe mint and dill and cumin, but what have they neglected? And what does he label justice, mercy, and forgiveness? The weightier matters of the law, right? He's making a contrast, right? You neglect the most important thing. Right? Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. And he says, you blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel. Which is, of course, one of those absurdist images. This designed to be a little bit comedic to the rest of the audience. And he is actually making fun of the Pharisees a little bit. But he's doing it with a point to show how absurd their behavior is, right? Elmore, you had your hand up. Yeah, Micah chapter 6, verse 8, right?
Yeah.
This is it. Yeah, go ahead, please, absolutely. You're out.
Yeah. So, has the
Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Right? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. Right? Yeah. And I was going to ask before Brother Elmore raised his hand and volunteered these things, I was going to ask, does this remind us of any passages in the Old Testament? And I was going to go to Micah 6, so thank you. But Elmore's right. I mean, this is exactly what Jesus is talking about. And this is nothing that the prophets haven't said before. Right? This is nothing that the prophets haven't said before. So thank you, Brother Elmore, for going straight to where I was going to go, which is awesome. So save me from saying all of it. So he's right, right? This is Jesus is drawing straight on Micah chapter 6, right? And so Micah's question is, you know, does God want the best thing that I have? Does he want everything that I have? Does he want my own flesh and blood? No, he wants you to do what's right. Right? He wants you to do what's right. That's it. He just wants you to do what's right. And, you know, that reminds that I keep going back to the parable of the Good Samaritan, right? Keep going back there. I mean, the scholar comes to Jesus and he asks him, you know, what good thing must I do to inherit eternal life, right? You know, what are the most important commandments in the law? And Jesus says, well, you're Mr. Smart Guy, you tell me, right? So the scholar gives him the answer, right? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and with all your mind. And the second is like it, you shall love your neighbors yourself. And Jesus says, well, congratulations, you've answered correctly, do this and you will live, right? And there you go, all right? You know the answer. We're done. Is understanding what God wants ever the problem? No. What is? Doing it, right? Doing, submitting to the will of God is always the hardest thing for human beings to engage in. It always has been. It probably always will be. Because that's just the way we people are. For better or worse, that's our reality. And that's, I mean, the parable of the Good Samaritan, as much as it is about mercy and compassion and all these other wonderful things that it is about, right? That's one of the most important takeaways from that section of Luke 10. Just shut up and do what God wants you to do, man. It's that simple. And that's what the prophets get at, right? That's what Samuel gets at. That's what Micah gets at, right? And that's what Jesus is getting at here. I mean, you give all these expensive gifts to God, like you think you can buy your way into heaven. Like you think you can buy your forgiveness, right? What does that remind us of, by the way? Those of us who remember our history. I know VR is thinking of it. Go ahead. Oh, buying your way into heaven? Oh, okay. The indulgences that the Catholic Church was selling in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, right? The beginning of Martin Luther's 95 theses that he nailed to the door of that church building in Germany, right? One of them was the practice of selling indulgence. The Catholic Church, the priests of the Catholic Church would sit around and say, hey, if you give us money, we'll promise you forgiveness for future sins. It's like, okay, that's not how it works. That's so not how it works. And the sins that you go on to commit that you know are sins and you do it anyway, right? Hebrews 10 says there's no sacrifice for those things. That's not how it works, guys, okay? And so Jesus is sitting here railing against the Pharisees for the same problem. You can't buy your way into heaven if you're living a life of sin, all right? That's just the way it works. Doesn't matter how much you give to God. If you don't give yourself to God, no amount of money that you give to God is ever going to be enough. And speaking of actions, right? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. What's this one all about? Inside versus outside, right? How does Jesus phrase this inside versus outside dilemma? You wash the outside of the cup. But what's the inside of the cup like? Dirty and grimy, right? It says, because you yourselves are full of greed and self-indulgence. Full of greed and self-indulgence. By the way, does that remind you of anything in the New Testament? It reminds me of James 3. Where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. Right? The Pharisees are the embodiment of the wisdom from below. It's exactly what they are. Right? First... He says, you blind Pharisee, first clean what? First clean the inside. And then the outside is going to match it. Right? Next one. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. And this one's sort of related to the last one, right? You're like, what does he say they're like in this instance? You're like whitewashed tombs. Right? That's like tombs that are painted all nice on the outside, right? But what are they full of on the inside? dead men's rotting flesh and dead men's bones. Ooh, that's kind of nasty, right? But again, that's the point, right? That's the point. You're full of decay, corruption, and death. There's nothing alive inside of you as far as God is concerned. So outwardly you appear righteous to others, but within you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and you decorate the monuments of the righteous, and you say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in the shedding of the blood of the prophets. What does Jesus say about that statement? He says, thus you bear witness against yourself. Thus you bear witness against yourself that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Why does he say that? Who did they murder? John the Baptist. Who are they going to murder? What's that? Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the Zechariah, son of Berechiah, the minor prophet Zechariah, right? Yeah, but you know he's referring to the post-exilic Jews, right? And he's saying you guys are cut from the same cloth, but he doesn't name names. But they sat by and they watched while John the Baptist was murdered, and they're going to have an active hand in calling for his murder too, right? And who else? What other prophets are they going to go on to murder? James, the son of Zebedee, the brother of John. Stephen, right? Stephanos, right? They're going to murder him. They're going to try to kill Paul a lot, and it's going to fail. It's going to take Caesar, the most powerful man in the world, to kill Paul. This is not the Jews, but you know they throw Peter and John in prison, have them beaten repeatedly. Yeah? Right? Fill up then the measure of your fathers. If you're going to be like your fathers, then you drink the cup of wrath that they drank. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood on the earth, the blood of the innocent, from the blood of the innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. This generation. It's your fault these things are happening. And he, like Mom said, he goes on. He uses the future tense. This is a prophetic oracle of the future. You're going to kill and beat and abuse my prophets. And you're going to suffer for it. So the generation that killed and beat and abused the prophets, right? By the way, he says, all these things will come upon this generation. What's next? And what's in verse 37? What's in verse 37? Right, but who is he talking to in that moment? This is important. Right, but how does he phrase it? Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets. and stones those who are sent to it. Yeah, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. He calls out Jerusalem for a reason. Okay? He calls out Jerusalem for a reason. It was their history, first of all, and that's where a lot of the prophets did die, as a matter of fact. But remember the verse prior. Remember verse 36. All these things will come upon this generation. And he connects it immediately to the city of Jerusalem. Why do you think he's doing that? Because of what happened there, right? Okay, but also because of what else? Not just because of what had happened there, but because of what will happen there in just a few days, but also because of what will happen there later on. So if Jerusalem is the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, who's going to suffer for the crimes of Jerusalem? Jerusalem. Jerusalem. Right? And we've got 5 minutes left, so I'm gonna do this. When the priests are in the middle of shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him, crucify him," and Pilate washes his hands and he says, "I want nothing to do with this." What do the priests say back to Pilate? Let his blood be upon us and on our children. Right? So they ask for the generation after them to suffer for their own crimes. Well, the thing is, whether they meant it or not, they got it. Be careful what you ask for, okay? Okay, so what's the general time frame that it takes for a generation to rise to power and become the dominant force in society? About how often? About 40 years. About 40 years. The counterculture movement of the 60s, right? The ones that was always against the man. Guess what happened about 40 years later in the early 2000s? They became the man. they started running the show, okay? Right? That's what happens. These things happen in cycles. So the Bible uses the same number of years because that's the way things work, right? So Jesus is crucified in 30 AD, right? I go with 30, not 33, right? Because either one is technically possible because those are the days, there's the only two years in the time frame that Jesus was operating under that Passover matched with the days of the week that they know they happened on, right? But I go with 30 because the Bible says he's 30 years old when he starts to preach, and we can peg down the fact that he was probably born in 4 BC, right? So if he's 33, 33 and a half when he dies, or 34 when he dies, then 30 is the likeliest date for crucifixion. So I say 30. And so the church started in Pentecost of 30 AD. That's my timeline, right? And there's, like I said, there's good solid reasons for that you can go to history to establish. And the Passover days of the week match up in 32. So he dies in 30 AD. What's 30 plus a generation? Again, the generation time frame is 40, right? So what's 30 plus 40? 70. What happens in 70 AD? Jerusalem is sacked and burned. The temple's destroyed. That's kind of poetic, isn't it? They got exactly what they asked for. Some of these men were still alive because they were young when this happened, right? And their children were alive. And Jesus says, "You're going to be the ones who suffer." That's exactly what happened, right? And also this being about, you know, the destruction. And, you know, the thing is, the generation that followed, we can say, well, it's not fair to punish their children for their sins. You know, they're the ones who killed the Messiah. Their children didn't. Yeah, but what did their children go on to do? Kill James, right? To persecute Paul, right? To imprison Peter, right? To have Paul beaten, to attempt to kill Paul multiple times. Their children were guilty of their own sins and they earned this multiple times over. And by the way, Jesus laments over Jerusalem at the end of chapter 23. "For I tell you, you will not see him again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Of course, that's the triumphal entry. But what's chapter 24 all about? the disciples come to him and say, when is this going to happen? Right? And they phrase it with the question, what is the sign of the end of this, of the end of the age? Well, to them, the destruction of the temple is the end of an age. And it really was. It truly was the end of an age. Because Judaism was no longer possible. Right? Law of Moses, lawful, covenant-oriented Judaism was no longer possible after 70 AD. And there's a whole host of reasons why that we can get into later. But the disciples come to him, ask him, when's our world going to end? Because that was the ending of the world as they knew it. Because from that point out, everything was changed and everything was different, right? So it's an accurate way to phrase it. And it doesn't have to be the absolute end of the world when Jesus comes to judge everybody, because that's not the question they're asking. The question they're asking is, when is what you're talking about going to happen? And Jesus says, I'll tell you, right? I'll tell you. And I'll give you some hints, and that'll be enough. So that's actually the end of our lesson this morning. Before we jump into Matthew 24, however, there is one observance that Jesus makes. There's one observation he makes in Mark 12 and Luke 21, right? So start on page 86, right? Question 18, the very top of the page, we'll cover that. And then we'll get into Matthew 24 and where Jesus talks about the destruction of Jerusalem next week. Because we're perfectly right at the ending time. Everybody, if you would, please read that and then go on to read Matthew 24 so we'll be able to discuss it, and 25 as well. So I want to thank everybody for being here, for your participation, your comments in class. As always, I appreciate it very much. And we'll have about a 10-minute break in our worship service. And men of the congregation, please remember to meet in the back room to make Brother Cooper's job easier. And we are now officially dismissed.